Welcome to radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to firehouse.com.
Welcome. This is Through the Smoke at Radio at Firehouse.com. I'm your host, Billy Goldfeder. We've got a great part two to the show you listened to last or a couple weeks ago. We're going to be talking about 100,000 firefighters who were not wrong, and they proved it to us. I've got two doctors on from the University of Cincinnati talking in depth. This is going to be a real deep discussion, gang. This is firefighters talk, information that we need to be talking about, listening to, and reacting upon related to preventing cancer and firefighting. And it's simple stuff. And honestly, some of the ways we're getting it is amazing. I mean, talk about firefighters going inside. We know that's a problem. But what about the firefighters operating outside the building? Safety officers, fire photographers, chiefs, command officers, EMS personnel, all those folks with all that smoke floating by, who knew that was going to be a problem for us? So we're going to get on with that interview in just a few seconds. But first, a couple of comments. One more thing I want to remind you of is that Firehouse World is coming up. Starts on February 25th out in San Diego. This will be the fifth year of firefighters getting together out in San Diego, hosted by Firehouse and Cygnus, for an outstanding time. There's incredible hands-on training, the conference program, pre-conference seminars, amazing exhibit hall, and San Diego ain't a bad place to be in the wintertime. So check it out at firehouse.com. We'll have a link at the bottom of the show here. And also we'll be doing a live broadcast at Firehouse World for Through the Smoke. And if you're interested in that, we'd love for you to come by and join us. We're going to have three very well-known fire chiefs joining us, and you can join us with them for a good interaction, your comments, your thoughts, your questions. And we'll have a really good time out in San Diego, so I look forward to seeing you. Let's take a look at some of the headlines that are going on in the fire world this week. You know, any fire department's weakest link can really be anywhere if training, lack of leadership, supervision, planning, whatever. All that kind of stuff is lacking from that fire department. One of the most critical but often overlooked links is the one from the time of the fire to the time we return to quarters. It's that role of fire communications, and specifically the dispatchers, who are the first critical link in first responding. Actually, in some respects, dispatchers are the first responders. After all, they're dealing with the problem before war tones even go off, before we're even on the scene. You know, dispatchers sometimes take a very unfair beating from firefighters who've never even set foot in the dispatch center. There are some outstanding dispatchers, life-saving dispatchers, who make the difference every day. You and I all know who they are. You have a favorite dispatcher, so to speak. Oh, good, he's working or she's working. I know we'll be covered well on the other end of this incident. Any incident commander will tell you that a good dispatcher is like the right hand at a working incident. Well-trained, professional, give-a-damn, telecommunicating dispatchers make a major, major difference, just like good firefighters and fire officers. On the other hand, there are dispatchers who wouldn't know an engine from a truck. And then there is the long-time issue of downplaying. You know downplayers. They're the ones in our business, from some fire chiefs to some firefighters to dispatchers, who take the attitude that, quote, that call will probably be nothing, unquote. Their years of experience, or lack thereof, have created so much negative attitude and apathy that they, quote, know the call will be nothing, end quote. They don't want to put all that equipment on the road for nothing. You know that attitude. And while procedures must be in place to determine, based upon what is reported, the right amount of equipment and staffing to be sent on an alarm, I'm absolutely blown away when some people in our business blow off information that might be an emergency, or as some of them say, but what if it is not needed? You know, we don't own the fire apparatus or any of the stuff we have. The public owns this stuff. They own the buildings, the trucks, all that. It's theirs. Even if your fire department bought it with fundraising money, the cash came from the public. The cash came from someone outside the membership of your fire department. So when those someones call the fire department and they think they might have a problem, send them their people, send them their stuff, meaning your firefighters and the apparatus. Send them the fire apparatus even now the call might sound like nothing. Send them their EMS units even though it just might be indigestion. Why wouldn't we send even a little more than what might be needed when a caller calls? What will it hurt? Well, then some people might say, well, what if there's another call? Well, hell, push the next button. Send other stations. Call mutual aid. Deal properly with the first call first with a plan for the other calls as well. And the possibility of other calls shouldn't be a reason to not send what might be needed for the first call. Then somebody might say to me, but what if they have a wreck while responding? And I'd say back, teach them how to drive. It's a training issue, not a reason to not respond to the slightest possibility of a fire or a related problem. If the caller felt it was worth calling, it is worth responding to. Take a listen to these recordings on this link here. This unfortunate situation occurred in Texas, where a dispatcher, a seasoned fire dispatcher it seems, downplayed the calls from citizens until 45 minutes later companies were finally dispatched and the building was destroyed by the fire. The fire was in a barbecue restaurant, and maybe the smoke was from restaurant folks inside smoking brisket. That's what the dispatcher suggested. Well, what if they aren't smoking brisket? Who knows what the hell they're smoking in there? And they weren't. The building was on fire. If you worry about the risk of sending all that equipment to a call, you're worried it might be nothing, worry more about the risk to firefighters having a chance to knock down a smaller fire because we get the call quickly, we get there quickly and deal with it, than a larger, more dangerous one with a self-imposed delay later, and in this case, much later self-imposed delay. And then, of course, there's the issue of the building being saved and even people's lives possibly being saved inside. We have to act as if every possible report of a fire, smoke, smell, whatever, is a working fire until we get there and determine what it actually is. The public gives us the apparatus with the expectation that when they need their engines and trucks and their firefighters, we'll respond, get there, and make their problem a little better. After all, it's their problem. We shouldn't downplay it until companies get on the scene and determine what is actually needed. Good professional, non-downplaying fire dispatchers are the first link in making a citizen's bad day get better and absolutely helping firefighters successfully return to quarters after every run. Sadly, 9 firefighters were killed in Karachi, Pakistan. There seem to be every day finding more and more bodies of these firefighters in the rubble of this factory that collapsed out there as firefighters were attempting to rescue factory workers. The building came down and killed these firefighters. I guess it was a pillar of the building crumbled and the roof came in before they could get out. So our hearts go out across the world to the firefighters in Karachi, Pakistan and their families for the suffering that they're going through right now. I don't know if you've seen this story or not, but 9 fire officers have been disciplined in the death of a fire recruit. Looks like at least 9 Miami-Dade fire rescue employees down in Florida have been disciplined for their roles in a 2003 training exercise at Port Everglades that resulted in the death of a fire recruit, according to the fire department reports. Fire recruit Wayne Mitchell, 37 years old, died when he became separated from his fellow fire students during an exercise that simulated a fire inside a cargo ship. Mitchell and the other trainees were using a hose line as a guide through a steel structure that became so hot, 3 fire instructors bailed out early. When the fire cadets headed out because of the heat, Mitchell lost the hose. He wandered away, collapsed, and died. His widow, Nancy, settled a lawsuit with that county for over almost $2 million and has a pending lawsuit against some other folks involved, the training center contract, the training center, the facility, the trainers, and all sorts of other folks that were involved in that. Stephen McKinnon, who was the acting division chief of the Miami-Dade Fire Department's train division at the time, received a 30-day suspension, according to a disciplinary report finalized last month. One instructor received a 2-week suspension, and 7 instructors were given written reprimands. Some officials who were involved in that training exercise have since retired from the fire department. The report indicated that McKinnon failed to take steps to ensure the exercise complied with national safety standards, and he didn't take into account complaints that recruits were being threatened and intimidated. The report also nailed McKinnon for a strained relationship between the training and safety bureaus. Because of that disharmony, the safety bureau was not at that training exercise, according to the report. Several agencies conducted investigations after Mitchell died, including the Florida Division of State Fire Marshal, which criticized Miami-Dade fire officials for failing to take safety precaution. Its report, released in 2005, noted trainees had been hurt during previous exercises under the supervision of the same instructors who were at the fatal exercise, and no firefighters were available during that training to rush into the building to make a rescue. In other words, there was no RIT team standing by, and there was no EMS nearby as well. Miami-Dade Fire Rescue also did an internal review and revamped its training procedures from top to bottom, according to a Miami-Dade Fire Rescue official. Well, we can only learn from that, and we have links to this story as well as the reports on your website right there. It should be as a part of your Through the Smoke listing of links for this show, so check it out. I don't know if you saw this other story. There's a firefighter in New Jersey who is filed a complaint. They're filing this complaint against Federal Signal because exposure to the apparatus siren has left them with hearing damage. Carmela DeJesus' lawsuit filed in Hackensack, New Jersey, is one of four that became public last week, joining others that have been filed in Illinois in the past 5 years. The 25-year veteran of the Hoboken Fire Department claims the siren emits intense noise at levels which over time are capable of causing permanent injury to human hearing. Repeated exposure to the sound damaged his hearing, he alleges. The manufacturer never warned him of the danger and made no effort to rectify the defect, says that 48-year-old firefighter. As a result, his lawsuit says, he suffers from high-frequency loss that, coupled with aging, will severely affect his hearing later in life. Well, you know, I guess that's the way of the world these days, and I certainly can understand that a loud siren can hurt his hearing. But, you know, this one bothers me. Yeah, we're supposed to wear headsets, but maybe years ago we didn't have headsets. We're supposed to be seat-belted, but you know, I guess this reminds me of a firefighter recently who filed a complaint because he fell out of his apparatus, but he wasn't wearing a seatbelt. Yeah, sirens can be loud, and this may be absolutely true, and that's certainly up to a court to decide. That's the beauty of our country. But, boy, this any firefighter with hearing loss, are they going to jump on this bandwagon, or are we going to acknowledge the fact that maybe it wasn't the siren? Well, we'll see. That's what judges and attorneys are for. They're a lot smarter than I am. Here's another one for you. A firefighter paramedic wrongly determined that a man was dead. A Vancouver, Washington firefighter paramedic wrongly determined that a suicidal man was dead, only to learn an hour later the man was still breathing. As a result, Jesse Avery, who's been with the Vancouver Fire Department for 3 years, was suspended for 30 days. Avery also lost his status as a state-certified paramedic, which represents an advanced level of training. Of course, you guys and gals understand that. He's expected to continue working for the fire department, but he'll be on probation for 3 to 5 years. I guess the lesson here is where Avery and his crew were sent to this location where the fire department crew found a homeless man in a detached garage. He had what appeared to be a suicide note on his lap. They said Avery examined the man, concluded that he was dead, and left the scene while police and an official from the ME's office remained. An hour later, the police and other officials called the fire department back, reporting that the man was breathing. I guess the issue is he didn't follow his protocols and didn't follow his policies when you suspected death in the field. And you got to follow your protocols, and you got to follow your SOPs and SOGs. Basically, you got to cover your butt. Something may look like it, but if you got a policy and procedure that says to do this or do that, just do it. And for you fire departments that don't have policies and procedures, that's a whole other issue. Shame on you. You got to cover your butt. And speaking of covering our butts, the next chief of the Minneapolis Fire Department will not be allowed to have sex with other firefighters. Here's a good story for you. The same goes for Minneapolis assistant chiefs and certain deputy chiefs. While battalion chiefs on 24-hour shifts can't work in the same district as the firefighters that they're sleeping with. It's all spelled out in the new Minneapolis Fire Department nepotism and romantic relationship policy. The policy may be the result of some previous problems there. As the city begins its search for a new leader, they want to avoid any repeats of the problems they had within the last couple of years involving their former chief. The short term of that chief was marked by at least three intimate relationships with other female firefighters, allegations of favoritism or retaliation, and a sex-tinged culture in city firehouses. That fire chief, she and others had well-publicized relationships that were a problem, I guess, and created a lot of tension, a lot of problems within the department. That fire chief is keeping a job in the department. They didn't fire her, but she took a voluntary demotion and is now in a non-supervisory type position. This new policy is, I guess, almost identical in language to romantic relationship policies at numerous colleges and universities, addressing dating guidelines between teachers and students. It's an interesting situation. The policy states that the fire chief, assistant chiefs, and certain deputy chiefs may not be initially appointed or remain in these management positions if they have a sexual or romantic relationship within the fire department. That's a hot issue, I guess. It's interesting. I don't know. Some may agree with it, some may not. But I guess if you just keep things where they belong, keep your clothes on and behave yourselves and remember what we're there at the fire department for, that's to help people with a problem. And I don't mean people with sexual problems or anything like that. I mean when people dial 911 and they need help, we need to be ready to respond. And anytime things like this happen in the department and it causes dissension and other issues, it provides a pretty bad impression of your fire department, my fire department, me, you, anybody, to the public. So I guess it's probably better to not play where you work. Well, hopefully that issue can be put to bed soon. Well, we're going to go on now to a much more serious issue, and not that what happened out there isn't serious, but let's talk about cancer for a little while. We'll be right back. We're going to be talking with Dr. LeMasters and Dr. Lockie from the University of Cincinnati about their incredible firefighter cancer study. We'll be right back.
Welcome to the latest edition of Through the Smoke with Deputy Fire Chief Billy Goldfeder, addressing issues impacting all firefighters' safety, health, and morale.
You're back. This is Through the Smoke at RadioFirehouse.com. I'm your host, Billy Goldfeder. Well, you know, 100,000-plus firefighters cannot be wrong. They prove this. They prove the issues of firefighting smoke and our cancers. As firefighters, the discussions on the previous Through the Smoke show of a few weeks ago could not have made our hair stand up any more than it did. That firefighter cancer study done by University of Cincinnati Environmental Health Research absolutely blew us away. Well, sort of. It's not as if we didn't know about the problems. We just didn't really worry about it. But maybe now it seems we are. Well, maybe. The University of Cincinnati-led team analyzed information on 110,000 firefighters from 32 previously published scientific studies to determine the comprehensive health effects and correlating cancer risks of our profession. Whew. So why now? We always knew to wear our SCBA, but we didn't always listen. In some towns, we still don't listen. I was looking at video and photos of a fire in a large city this week where firefighters were proud of their new bunker gear, but were not wearing their SCBAs, and you couldn't see 6 feet in front of you. We know wearing SCBAs makes sense, but we really didn't just worry about it over the last couple years, and again, some towns still don't worry about it. After all, it's just some smoke. We also never thought about a little soot on our face or soot on our hands. Never thought that was much of a problem. We really never thought about those outside, working outside the fire. I mean, sure, we talk about bunkering up and wearing our masks if we're crawling inside the building. But what about the chiefs, the pump operators, the safety folks, the sector commanders, the EMS personnel, and even the fire photographers and others who are actually in the smoke outside the building, even though it'll probably just clear up in just a little while? Well, it's a problem, and we're learning more and more and talking with our friends at the University of Cincinnati that it is a real problem. Personally, I knew about the lung problem. It never dawned to me about the soot on our faces. After all, many of us would go back to quarters after a fire and just hit the bed and sleep for a couple hours with all that black soot all over us, or not even so visible soot all over us. And little did we know, we couldn't try harder to introduce some cancer-causing agents into our bodies. Well, this week we're back. Again, our repeat guest is Dr. Grace LeMasters, who has her Ph.D. Studying the issues of firefighter health, particularly the effects of smoke. And we're also joined this week by Dr. James Locke, an M.D. from the University of Cincinnati, who worked with Dr. LeMasters in this study. Also, we will have additional guests on to discuss this later on as we move through the show and talk further about personal health issues for firefighters. So I want to welcome Dr. James Locke. His specialty is environmental health. He's a professor of occupational environmental and pulmonary medicine at the University of Cincinnati. Dr. Locke, welcome, sir.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And, of course, Dr. LeMasters is back with us again. She's a repeat offender to our show. Welcome again, Dr. LeMasters.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to start with Dr. Locke, since we did speak with Dr. LeMasters a little bit last time, and then we'll get into a little bit of a group discussion. Dr. Locke, what were your thoughts when you start? I mean, what motivated you, I guess, to begin with, to start looking at the issues of cancer and firefighting?
Well, we worked closely with the Ohio Bureau of Worker Compensation at the university, and we have a research grant through them. They are the actual organization within the state that raised the issue to us, as they had a number of firefighters who would apply for worker compensation to the state system, and they were finding that they really did not have enough information to provide them answers as to the possibility or probability of a potential cancer being work-related. So, in fact, they asked us to look at this issue for them.
Okay, so they approached you to start looking into the issue. And what were, I guess, as you started looking at this, let's just review again for those who may have not listened to the show from a few weeks ago. You looked at over 100,000 different cases, and this was over what period of time?
The study started back in the 1925 on up until approximately 1997. And what we did initially was we went back to see how many studies have been done on firefighters in relationship to cancer mortality. And we found that there were a lot of studies in the literature, but nobody had really put all the studies together into one big analysis for the last 10 to 15 years. We think the last analysis similar to what we did was done in approximately 1990.
Okay.
So we felt that there were enough studies that were done after 1990 on different firefighter units throughout the country that we then could do an additional meta-analysis or a group analysis to see if anything has changed over time.
Let me ask you a question. You know, we use a term that the smoke of today is not the smoke of the firefighters that went before us. When you looked at these issues of firefighting cancers, was there a particular year? I mean, you know, in the 1920s and 30s, much of the smoke, and I'm going to guess this, I don't have any scientific background, but I'm guessing as a firefighter, most of the smoke that the firefighters before us breathed in the 20s and 30s and into the 40s were more of a natural smoke compared to the smoke that we're encountering today, which is almost 100% non-natural, meaning the materials that are burning, the buildings themselves are all made of man-made materials.
I mean, if you're asking me, that's correct. And this smoke, especially smoke from combustion products in the last 30 to 40 years, it's become much more complex in relationship to what is burning. When you're burning plastics, when you're burning carpeting, upholsteries, different type of metals, depending on the temperature within the fire, you're going to have different types of things given off into the atmosphere. If the temperature is at 500 degrees versus 1,000 degrees versus 2,000 degrees, the pyrolysis products or the burning products are going to be different. And so it's very difficult to really pinpoint from one fire to the next what exactly a person is exposed to. But we know there are definite carcinogens in various paralysis products, particularly in relationship to man-made products such as different types of plastics, upholsteries, and carpetings and things like that.
Which is pretty much what we're finding in literally every fire we're going to, other than perhaps a woods or a wildland fire. Dr. LeMasters, certainly feel free to chime in as we go on. Now, let me ask you further. Now, you mentioned the degrees, the temperatures, and it ponders the question to me, does the higher temperature mean necessarily worse smoke? Or, in other words, would a firefighter listening to this thinking, well, if we've only got a small bedroom fire, the smoke's not as much a problem as if we've got a rip-roaring factory fire? I'm going to guess that's probably not the case, that all the smokes, is there a correlation, I guess, between the temperature and the severity of the smoke or the different types of smoke or what?
It depends on what is burning. There is a temperature that you can reach at which most things are destroyed. And some of the incinerators that burn toxic materials reach such a high temperature that the majority of the things that are burnt are destroyed. But that doesn't exist really in the type of fires that firefighters are involved with. So the range of carcinogens in these types of burning products is going to be dependent on what is burning and what the temperature is. And a certain material at a lower temperature may be giving off more carcinogens than another material at a higher temperature. So
that's great information. That's kind of where I was going with that. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
It's material dependent as well as temperature dependent.
With the purpose of today's discussion, let's stick with the standard house fire where the carpeting is man-made, where the furniture is man-made, where the paints are man-made, even the vinyl siding on the buildings. And we're even starting to see some man-made building materials being used as a part of the structure in the use of the beams, the floors, and other things. So considering today's house fire, what I got from this first part of this discussion is the intensity of the fire does not necessarily mean the smoke is worse or any better. And a small smoldering fire, or once we have a fire put out and the materials are just smoldering, is just as dangerous or even perhaps more dangerous than during the actual fire attack. Is that possible?
I think that's correct. If you would take an example of, say, if the home burning such as you described.
Sure.
And we could say that in the center of the home is the hottest part of the fire. And as you move away from that center where the temperature is the highest and you move towards the periphery, other things will be burning but a lower temperature. And as you get out to the periphery of the building, they may be just smoldering. So looking across that whole burning atmosphere, what may be given off in the very hot part of the building is going to be different. That's what is being given off 20 feet away from the hot part of the building versus relatively further removed from the hot part of the building. So there's a gradient, and it's temperature dependent, and also dependent on what is burning in that gradient.
Right.
It's a very complex environment. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. Depending on what temperature is in the fire and what's burning in that particular location.
Complex environment, but not a particularly complex solution based upon the discussions I had with Dr. LeMasters a few weeks ago. I mean, I came back, and I know we had an incredible amount of listeners to the show last week. This is the tip of the iceberg in our business. At my age of 51, I know so many firefighters that have either died or are suffering from cancer right now, and it's just what a wake-up call. And the goal isn't as much to educate the 51-year-olds. But, I mean, not that they're not important, but to educate the 19-year-olds who in 20 years from now will be hitting our ages and will have a much greater opportunity with education and information from such as your folks like yourselves, but also to take better action. And what I got from it, one, is I've got to be honest with you. Up until our discussion with Dr. LeMasters a few weeks ago, soot on my face was about the last thing I was worried about. And we'd go back to the firehouses, and I think Dr. LeMasters said it best, we'd go back to the firehouse, we'd be covered with this soot, or even not even necessarily covered. Maybe certain parts of our body, maybe it got up into our bunker gear, and we'd go to bed, and we'd go to sleep because we're too exhausted to take a shower or decon, so to speak. And this stuff, using firefighter technical terms, would sit on our skin, and I mean, we probably couldn't come up with a better way to try and introduce this stuff than what we'd been doing for years. And that really struck me, is we've got to clean up as soon as we get back to quarters. That's the immediate thing that we can do right now. We can immediately wear all of our protective clothing with absolutely no exposed skin, wear our masks, and what have you. But the issue of a second set of bunker gear came to light. We looked at it as a matter of convenience. You'd come back from a fire and your gear would be soaking wet. So a second set of bunker gear for the firefighter would be a nice thing to have, but now it seems to be a necessity based upon what you, both of you and those involved in your study have come up with. Please comment on that.
Yes, we would both agree with that. By not having a clean pair or a clean set of bunker gear to go out with the next fire, you're really just adding insult to injury by putting the contaminated, and I'll use that term, it's not just dirty, but it's contaminated bunker gear that you are wearing right back next to your skin, which, or close to your skin, which can be then absorbed through your skin, especially when you're hot and your tissue, your blood vessels have dilated, and it can even act as a sort of a bandage or a wrap on your next to your body, enhancing the likelihood of these cancer-causing agents to be absorbed.
It was always creating the right atmosphere. The right atmosphere, a sad but appropriate term.
Yes, an adverse atmosphere.
Right.
So it's not just dirty, and we have to, all firefighters need to get away from the thought that it's dirty. It's contaminated with chemicals.
It's chemical
residues that are in that soot.
Dr. Locke, any comments on that?
I agree with what Dr. LeMaster just said. The mind thought has to be that it's going to be very difficult to predict from one fire to the next, or even in one fire location, from one location at that fire to the other location of the fire, what potential carcinogens a firefighter will be exposed to. It's going to be almost impossible to predict from one situation to the other. You obviously can't measure them because you have immediate duty, which is to guard the safety of the people living in the building that's burning, as well as extinguishing the fire. So that's the immediate duty. But there are measures you can take to protect against cancer, which is a chronic disease, and that those measures are recognized that you are going to be potentially exposed to carcinogens from one fire to the next, and that these carcinogens need to be removed from the skin as soon as feasible. And that will help protect the long-term health of the firefighter. That's the best recommendation we can give. You really don't want this material on your skin for a long period of time. You want to remove it by taking a shower and changing into new bunker gear.
Right. Well, that certainly is a fiscal impact, it sounds like that's an important item for the agenda for many departments. Many departments do provide two sets of bunker gear, but so many don't. So many departments just barely have enough money to buy bunker gear for their own members. But I think looking at the long-term cost of this, there's a value in coming up with a solution of creating that second set of gear for all members of the fire department. Let me go to another area specific to your findings, but more about the human side of this. What are some of the symptoms? What are some of the things that firefighters should be looking for? And I know that you guys did the study and are not maybe specific cancer experts, but certainly you can provide some information that naturally going for their annual physical and things like that. But what's some of the stuff that firefighters should be watching for as warning signs to make sure that they're staying healthy?
Well, in relationship to cancer as a general adverse health outcome, there are things that somebody can do to mitigate against the risk of getting cancer. In relationship to the four cancers that we found that were elevated, there are some specific things that can be done. For instance, with testicular cancer, men should examine their testicles on a regular basis, on a monthly basis, to determine whether there's any change in the consistency of the testes. When a testes becomes more firm or harder, that indicates there might be something adverse going on, and they need to see their physician for that. Testicular cancer, if detected early, is a curable cancer, but it has to be detected early, and that means that men need to examine themselves as women examine themselves for breast cancer on a regular ongoing basis, and if they find something, they need to see their personal physician about that. In relationship to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and multiple myeloma, that's more difficult. There's really nothing that an individual can do to pick up that disease process at an early point in time, except for a non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, if they find that they have a lump in their neck that's not related to a upper respiratory infection that becomes more firm with time and doesn't go away as the infection gets better, then they can see the physician about that, because if detected early, there's a better chance for a cure with that disease. Multiple myeloma is a disease that usually occurs in the older age group, in the 60s and 70s, and that disease is related to our lifetime situation and potentially our lifetime exposures, and that goes back to helping try to prevent those types of lifetime exposures by wearing proper equipment, showering, getting these materials off your skin. Prostate cancer is a real dilemma for people who are looking at this particular disease, because an etiology of prostate cancer really hasn't been definitively defined yet. Our study showed that prostate cancer is related to working as a firefighter, but I can't tell you what one or more specific agents are causing it. So eliminating chronic exposures over time will help decrease the risk of getting this. There are certain screening tests that we can do now for prostate cancer, and when somebody sees their physician, they should always make sure the physician does a prostate exam to make sure there's nothing abnormal and does the proper blood test to see if there's any early indication of prostate cancer.
You know, it might be advantageous for the firefighter to take the results of our study, or even just one table 5 of our study, to their family physician so that they will also be educated that as a firefighter you are at increased risk for cancer such as prostate cancer, and they might begin the preventative measures of doing blood tests sooner rather than later if they are educated and aware of the risks. I mean, we can't assume that family docs are going to know about this study, but the firefighters should know about this study and use that to help educate their healthcare provider.
That's some great advice, and what we will do is we will provide a link at the bottom of the show for our listeners to click and get the PDF file of the study and provide it to either your fire department physician, your personal physician, or even your fire department's safety and health committee for
Absolutely.
Distribution to the membership.
Well,
go ahead,
Doc. Got an email yesterday from a firehouse chief who was concerned that diesel exhaust is still being vented inside their building. There's no external exhaust for the diesel exhaust from their fire trucks. Well, this is a situation that should be corrected in all firehouses immediately. We know that diesel exhaust is a cancer-causing exposure. So, and again, it was rated by the International Agency for Research on Cancer as a probable to possible cancer-causing agent to humans. So there's no question that all firehouses have to make the investment in their personnel, in the health of their firefighters, by making some relatively simple changes.
Yeah, the diesel, you know, between bunker gear and diesel exhaust, the Federal Fire Act grant program targets those as some of the more recognized awards. Many fire departments have received grants to install exhaust removal systems, the hoses that hook up to the apparatus, and bunker gear. So certainly, if a local community can afford it, the answer is to solve the problem. But if money's an issue, look into the Fire Act grant program as well.
You know, maybe a link to that.
Oh, yeah, we'll provide that link on there for sure.
Yes, because the firefighter that contacted me, who is a chief in Ohio, had no idea about potential resources.
Sure. If you, matter of fact, when we're done with the interview, if you want to forward me his information or forward him my email, I'll give him all the information right away, and we'll solve that. But we'll also have it on this show as well. You know, in your study, you looked at primarily white males, which is no surprise because that, for many, many years and still is, the predominant makeup of the fire service. But an interesting news clip ran the other day that we posted on firefighterclosecalls.com is that a firefighter in San Francisco, a woman who recently passed away from cancer, her cancer was determined by the workers' comp folks to be job-related. So as more women become a part of the fire service, and they're certainly on their way, and they're an integral part of what we do today, and more women are joining on a regular basis, that would also alter this information and change, I guess, the if the right word would be demographics of your study, as more women become a part. Different types of cancers that are inherited to women may pop up as well. What do you think?
Well, of the 32 studies that we evaluated, only I think one of those had any women in the study, and they were not analyzed. So we did not examine reproductive organs for women, breast, uterine, cervical, ovarian, etc. So because we didn't examine it, we should not feel that it is not a problem. We just don't know because nobody, to our knowledge, has really looked at cancer in firefighters. And the problem is it takes a large sample size of women in order to look at differences in gender. And we just may not have enough.
The population just isn't there yet, right?
Right.
Let me ask you guys another question, a little less technical. Talking, you've spent time now, did either of you have much exposure to firefighters or firefighting prior to you taking on this project?
We have, through our Senator Vonovich here at the University of Cincinnati, have been involved with doing medical surveillance on first responders in relationship to the 9/11 disaster.
Okay.
And so I have personally interviewed firefighters as part of that surveillance program for first responders who went to New York from the tri-state area.
So prior to 2001 or following 9/11, you've probably come away with obviously a better understanding of firefighters. Maybe share with us some of your observations and feelings and your advice to firefighters. I know a lot of people who are non-firefighters who start to get to know what we do and how we do it are intrigued, but sometimes surprised at some of our behaviors, our actions, the way we do our job, sometimes how we're forced to do our job. Any interesting observations from either of you since you're starting to get to know the fire service, say, in the last 8 years?
Well, I have found firefighters to be a very unique group of individuals. They're very enthusiastic about their job. They're very dedicated in regard to their job, and they're very community oriented. What I discovered also is that they certainly recognize the immediate hazards of their job in relationship to the potential consequences of exposure to carbon monoxide or being exposed to high temperatures or having something fall on them when they're actually involved with a firefighter job task and actually involved with fighting the fire. They also have told me that it doesn't take long for them to develop fatigue and heat stress and that they have to remove themselves from the situation to recover from that before they can go back in and continue what they were doing previous to that. Uniformly, what they, I think, have not recognized is that when they're on the periphery of the fire, that there is also a potential hazard there, but that hazard is not immediately recognized. It's a hazard that occurs over a long period of time. And most of the firefighters are not aware of that potential hazard.
So you're thinking, what you're saying is, when we get smoke inhalation from inside a building, it's obvious and recognized and it has to be dealt with immediately. However, the firefighter who's outside operating the pump or operating the area ladder or the sector officers operating outside in that secondary smoke environment, so to speak, is not going to immediately recognize a problem, and that's the long-term issue.
Right, and that's, I think that's human nature. It's like I'm if I was smoking cigarettes and I would say, well, I'm smoking 3 or 4 cigarettes a day and that's not really an issue I need to worry about because it most likely it's not going to have a health effect, and if it does, it's not going to be till I'm 60 or 70 years old. The same situation with firefighters is that there is an immediate hazard that they have to recognize because of the nature of fighting fires. It's a dangerous job, and you could die from smoke inhalation or carbon monoxide poisoning or something fall on you or you burnt to death. So if you get out of the building and that hasn't happened to you, it's going to feel great, no question about that. And that I think enables somebody to minimize what may be happening in small increments over time.
Right. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And that
not going to worry about that incidental exposure on your skin that may have a health effect when you're 60.
Well, especially with the younger firefighters, that's right on target. Is they come out of the fire academy ready to kick butt and do the job, and a little smoke here or there is not going to be an issue. And unfortunately, my generation and generations that are past my generation glorified some of the stupid stuff that we'd been doing, not worrying about the smoke, not worrying about the soot, not wearing our masks, and that's obviously the goal of what we're doing talking to you guys today is trying to change that attitude, change that culture. They can still be good, positive, aggressive, gung-ho, enthusiastic firefighters and live longer to do it by taking a few of these steps that we've been discussing.
You're absolutely correct.
Dr. LeMasters, your advice or thoughts to firefighters as we start to wrap up the show?
Well, I would like to go back to something I mentioned in the previous show, and that has
to do
with the immediate duty. The immediate duty of senior firefighters are also to junior firefighters, because the junior firefighters are looking up to them as the experienced firefighter. And if they are going to mimic the same behaviors, So if senior firefighters make it a requirement in their lives, in their working lives, to always clean up after fires, to always shower, and to bug the junior ones to do it also, I think that will go a long way in changing the culture of firefighting. I think, you know, wearing the protective clothing, and if there could be some clothing developed so that it's tighter around the wrists and the legs, so fire is not getting up into the skin, the whole body being covered, that would be an important step also.
You know, that's interesting you mentioned that, because the International Association of Firefighters did receive a grant and have developed a new type of bunker gear. It's called Project Heroes, and we'll have a link to that at the bottom of this show, that not only creates a better seal, but actually as the firefighter exhales their breath from their air pack, instead of that air going into the environment, that exhaled air is actually being pushed very simply back into the bunker gear, creating an air pressure, almost a positive pressure, which was designed initially to minimize terrorist-type materials, weapons of mass destruction-type stuff, from getting into the gear. But since discussions with you and others, I know talking with the folks there, they're realizing that on a day-to-day basis, this type of protective clothing will go long ways in keeping the carcinogens out and addressing the issues that the two of you have been talking about with us.
Yes, that sounds like a great idea.
Well, any final comments from Dr. Locke or Dr. LeMasters?
I would just ask the firefighters that they need to be cognizant of the fact that as they are very aware of the acute hazards of fighting a fire, as a secondary precaution, they should also be aware that small exposures over a long period of time also has a potential risk for disease when we're 50, 60, and 70 years of age.
Dr. LeMasters?
I think that is essentially my message also, that, you know, the young firefighters, we think when we're young that we're invincible, but within 20 years, it takes 20 years, usually at a minimum, for cancers to present themselves. 20 years goes by very fast, and so if they're starting at age 20, by 40, very young men at age 40 will be potentially facing these risks for cancer.
And we're certainly seeing that more and more as we speak to the folks involved with the studies, as well as the various firefighter cancer organizations, which we have listed here at the bottom of the show, that this situation is continuing to show its ugly head, and there are things we can do to reduce it and to start turn this around. Well, our sincere thanks to Dr. Locke and Dr. LeMasters. Dr. Locke, specialty of environmental health, occupational and environmental medicine. He's a professor of occupational environmental pulmonary medicine at the University of Cincinnati. And Dr. Grace LeMasters, a professor of epidemiology. For your time, you've made a major, major difference, and we certainly appreciate your help.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, and have a great year.
Thank you, sir, and thank you, ma'am. We'll be back on Through the Smoke at RadioAtFirehouse.com after this break.
RadioAtFirehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
You're back. This is RadioAtFirehouse.com. I'm your host, Billy Goldfeder. The show's Through the Smoke. Wow, it's pretty heavy stuff. It's not like we didn't know it, but this sure puts it in our faces. So take the time to check out these links that we've got below, and use a little common sense. I mean, let's face it, I haven't been the smartest person in my life, and I've done a lot of stupid crap over the years. And I'll tell you, though, after listening to these discussions in the last couple weeks, I'm not letting that stuff stay on my skin. I'm harder on my firefighters. And I can tell you, I had a house fire a couple weeks ago, and one of my shift commanders, who you wouldn't think would act this way, is a lot harder on our folks now. You're going to wear your mask. We're going to check for carbon dioxide before you take your mask off. So we are able to impact some of the older folks. But the young guys and gals listening to the show, the drama of being a firefighter can't be beat. The excitement we enjoy in this job is second to none. So if that's the case and you love going to fires, then these two doctors and this show have provided you with information so you can go to fires a lot longer. Can you imagine age 40 or 45 being told you're done and now you got to start dealing with something as horrific as cancer? Take the actions now to make a big, big difference so you can keep going a long, long time so you can become one of those old-timers and deal with the young punks years and years from now. Well, thanks for listening. I want to remind you, Firehouse World is coming up. We'll be celebrating 5 years of training and education out in San Diego. In 07, Firehouse World will celebrate the 5 years of bringing it together in San Diego, and it's an event that gets bigger and better every year. Firehouse World offers hands-on training, pre-conference workshops, and classroom sessions taught by some of your most favorite fire instructors out there, and some new ones that maybe you've never heard before, and that's important too. A lot of good stuff and a lot of new people coming along the pike wanting to share their information. Check it out at firehouse.com. Firehouse World starts on Sunday, February 25th, with hands-on training for a couple days, and then the program starts on Tuesday and runs through Wednesday of that week. So the exhibit, I guess even to Thursday too, the exhibit hall hours looks like it's Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. So come out to San Diego, plan on arriving Saturday, sign up for those hot classes now, and then spend the week doing some great training and catching up with some of the brothers and sisters from around the country. And also, don't forget, and we'll have this posted on firehouse.com soon, we're going to do a live broadcast of Through the Smoke, and I've got a couple of very cool fire chiefs and fire officers lined up to join you. You'll be able to participate in the discussions. We'll have that information posted soon. Well, you've been listening to Through the Smoke. I'm your host, Billy Goldfeder. This is radio at firehouse.com. Have a good week. Be careful.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio at firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.